Welcome to Micro Brew, the latest edition of Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, and on the other line is Kurt Hoge, Brewers beat reporter for, of course, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Brewers, I mean, it's a good week. It is. They went 3-2 against two very tough opponents. They split in St. Louis. They take 2 of 3 from a very good New York Yankees team. And they had a lead in the third game, which we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about maybe the missed opportunity that was the Sunday afternoon game. The Brewers go into the new week 2 games behind. It's now the Phillies, who are the closest competition in the chase for the wild card. But again, as always, it's 3 games because a tie simply will not do. In the new rules, the Brewers will not go to the playoffs if they finish tied with Philly. They got to surpass them. So after my conversation with Kurt, I have a nice chat with Kyle Loebner. He's a guy who's written about the Brewers a lot over the last 20 years. He's a number of ventures, which we talk about. You might be seeing his stuff in the Shepherd Express. But he lives in Appleton and sees a lot of Wisconsin Timber Rattlers games. And in fact, this year got to be the official scorer for the Timber Rattlers for a lot of games. And what he's seen are some of the rule changes that are being implemented by Major League Baseball next year. They have been in place at the minor leagues, in the minor leagues and at the Midwest League level. So he got to see the pitch clock in action and over the course of the season and the shift and the bigger bases and things like that. So I wanted to get his thoughts on what he saw over the course of the season, like if what his observations have been and what maybe fans can expect next year. And also a little bit about some of the guys who've been at Wisconsin this year, including, of course, the headline of the number one prospect in the organization, that being Jackson Churio. Well, the Brewers, down to the nitty-gritty, they're still kind of facing a fairly significant uphill battle, in my opinion, but Kurt, that's where we'll start. I've started the last few podcasts this way, just sort of an overall progress report of where you see them in the playoff standings and the wild card standings. Of course, the division is off the table at this point, but they did gain a little bit of ground. They went into Sunday a game and a half behind the Padres, who won and then were able to go now 2.5 ahead. They could still catch either one of the Phillies or the Padres. I mean, it feels like they've been treading water for a little bit, but that's better than the alternative. So give me a sense of where you see them right now.
It's funny because it feels like the team to catch flips every couple of days. I think like last week at some point, I was like, oh, the Phillies are definitely good. Like, if there's going to be a team that collapses here, it's the Phillies. And then the Padres looked really shaky for 4 or 5 games, and the Brewers made up a couple games, kind of over the last weekend. And then into, I guess maybe in the St. Louis series, well, I'm not sure they gained ground there. And I was like, it's the Padres again. And now the Phillies are kind of doing Philly things again. And San Diego, their pitching was really good the last few days. And I think they've won 4 or 5. And so it's, now it's the Phillies again. So I don't know. I think that there's just this sense that if the Brewers win enough games, one of those teams is going to collapse. The tiebreakers where things get, we've talked about this, the tiebreakers where things get murky. I think if the Brewers had a tiebreaker, you'd feel a lot better about their standing right now. But I mean, making up basically 3 games on the Phillies is very doable, especially kind of with Phillies to have some tough games remaining. And the Brewers after this Met series don't really have as difficult a schedule. So it's still a tough road to climb for them to get there, but they played, I mean, even in losing 12-8 on Sunday against the Yankees, they played significantly better. It's just that, kind of the back end arms of their entire staff didn't do the job on Sunday. I don't think you could really say they pitched any of their, picked out their like top 6 pitchers, none of those guys pitched. So it's a road to climb still, like I said, but it's doable, and they're starting to play a little bit like the team that we've kind of been waiting for them to play like since May.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The offense in particular has been good, and certainly maybe not coming up with all the clutch hits. There have been games here and there where they weren't able to hit in scoring position. That second loss in St. Louis was very frustrating, 0-9, because they had, they had chances. They pounded Adam Wainwright. They pounded Gerrit Cole, a very good pitcher, on Sunday. And it's a shame that it didn't work out, because that's not an opportunity you're afforded all that often. I would jumping back to the race to look at where we stand and which team is the team to really hone in on. I still think the Padres have the tougher schedule and will be the team that's more likely to get caught. But what's concerning is we've seen, like you said, their pitching's been really good. Josh Hader is kind of back. He looked really good on Saturday night. He's got a couple saves now in consecutive order. He's back to working the ninth inning of close games, and he looks good. I won't say that.
I think he's back. I think it's not maybe like peak Hader, but Josh Hader's back.
Yeah, and maybe not. Yeah. Even if he's not all the way back, he's still effective. He's not blowing games, and you know, the Brewers bullpen has been just okay. You know, not special, and maybe they're, you know, we're going to end up revisiting this, of course, at the end of the season, and it's now kind of looking like, yeah, the bullpen didn't really get that much better. I think you could certainly argue it stayed the same, or maybe got a tiny bit better overall, but not enough to see where we're at. But anyway, San Diego. We know the Brewers have the Mets, very good team, like you said. Then they got four in Cincinnati, then two versus the Cardinals, who they've played tough. That's a great team, but a team they've played tough. Four against Miami, three against Arizona to close the year. That's some favorable stuff with as many home games as they have and only the four road games left. San Diego, they have three against St. Louis this coming up next, starting this week. So they are going to, but that's in San Diego. They'll then go to Colorado. Then they've got the Dodgers, of course, a 100-win team. That's a very good squad, so that's going to be tough. The White Sox, who are still battling for a playoff spot, they're above 500. And then three against San Francisco in San Diego to close the year. San Francisco is a below 500 team. That's where they're going to finish. But still, not the worst, not the easiest of opponents. San Diego, meanwhile, has two against Toronto, very good team. Four against Atlanta, a very good team. Three at the Cubs, they're the Cubs. Four at Washington, they're Washington. And then three at Houston. Houston's the best team in the AL. They'll have everything wrapped up by then and probably won't necessarily be putting their best foot forward and setting their pitching rotation for the playoffs. So I don't know how good of a standpoint that is. Philadelphia has a lot of road games left. I think it's 10, maybe it's only 9 games on the road and 7 at home or something like that. But the Brewers have the easiest schedule of the three, for sure. I guess I just don't know if I see enough from the Brewers. I mean, this was an example of a good week, but you got to do better than good weeks. Like you got to go 4-1 against two really good teams. I mean, certainly they're still in this, but I just feel like this team still has not shown that even as good as maybe they've been in recent weeks, they're not good enough to like win 5 in a row. And I think they have to do that. They have to flourish here if they want to catch either one of these teams. These teams are, you know, there's some fraughtness in Philly that they're going to miss the playoffs again. They've had this long streak of missing the playoffs, and I'm sure there's going to be pressure down the stretch, but The Brewers have got to do something that I still don't know if we've seen, right?
So it sounds like you don't think they're going to make the playoffs.
I don't think they're going to make the playoffs. I think the ship is sailed.
Okay, that is cut and dry. You were like dancing around it, and I'm like, let's cut to the chase here, JR. You sound out.
I'm out. And honestly, I don't know if this was the week that did it. I've certainly been concerned with the last several weeks, but this was a good week of baseball, and it wasn't good enough. And now it's kind of like, well, that's as good as they're going to do. I don't know if there's another gear beyond what they just showed us. And I don't think it was enough. It's just from playing from behind. I mean, they're going to finish with a fine record with 87, 88 wins. And I think they're going to just miss.
I think this was their best baseball since, you know, like last Saturday against the Reds, I believe. That's the best baseball they've played since, you know, coming out of the break when they beat up on the Rockies and the Twins and the Red Sox, I believe. The problem was, you know, one of the games was against the Cardinals, or two of the games against the Cardinals and three were against the Yankees. And those are both really good teams. And you can lose games by playing, even if you play pretty well. The thing is, though, Jared, their wins were convincing. You know, it wasn't this grinded out. Do they really deserve to win this game? They're just going to kind of eke it out. I understand. Like,
there was Fridays a walk-off in there where they had to rally back.
Fridays was a walk-off, but they were down 5-0, and they significantly outplayed the Yankees nearly that entire game after Adrian Hauser left. So it was good baseball for the first time in a long time, and for that reason, along with the fact that I just feel like that one of these two teams ahead of them is going to run into a week where they go 1-6, 2-5. It opens the door significantly. I think I've told this to you recently. It feels to me like if they could just get within a game or a half game, then I would be fully on board with the fact that they're going to do it. Like I said, it's that third game right now that they have to make up over 16. That's going to be really tough with, like you said, they've just had a hard time winning 5 in a row. And they're going to have to do something that they haven't done in a long time. Now, the thing is, I've been saying they need to play like they haven't in a long time. And I really feel like this week they did that. I understand Sunday's loss is probably really frustrating to lose, and probably a game you can't lose when you score 8 runs on Gerrit Cole, but that's sort of the situation that the pitching staff is in, and I guess that's another reason to be pessimistic too, and we can talk about the pitching staff, but like they even played well in a really frustrating loss.
Okay, so indeed, let's talk about the pitching staff. And Sunday, I don't want to I feel bad disparaging Jason Alexander, because he is a great story. He has made the most of it, and I applaud him. The guy obviously doesn't have what you would consider, you know, lightning big league stuff, and he's here. He's in the big leagues. I don't understand why he's still starting baseball games. Now they're short starters, and I realize there are not many options to go with, you know, with Eric Lauer and Freddie Peralta on the shelf, and news this week that we think both those, they expect those guys will be back, Ashby too, at some point in the future, even though there's just not a lot of baseball left. They expect to get those guys back. But Jason Alexander isn't going to, like, he's not going to put you in position to win a game. He's going to give it everything he's got. But I think they've lost 10 of 12 games that he's appeared in. I think we were pretty critical of Ashby when that was the case for Ashby earlier this year. His whip, I mean, I think Adrian Hauser has taken some heat, probably rightfully, as not being maybe quite good enough. He's a number four, number five pitcher, and he has value for this team. But Adrian Hauser, as much as he has struggled this year, is still markedly better in whip than Jason Alexander. 1.6 whip is really, really high. And his ERA, you know, is over, well over five, 5.5 or something, a little bit south of that now, I think. But you know, when he pitches, I just don't get the sense that A, he can actually make it five innings or more, and B, I don't get the sense that they're going to be very strong innings. And you go into a matchup like Sunday with Cole versus Alexander, I don't know how anyone can expect that the Brewers are going to win that game. Now, I think that's an indictment on two things. One is, I think it shows how the Brewers just don't have any faith in Ethan Small, who has started a couple games this year, but was sort of, I think, supposed to be the depth for this situation. If they did lose a few guys, that Ethan Small could be the guy they turn to. They have not been willing to do that. He's on the 40-man roster. It wouldn't be a problem to bring him up here. They clearly are not prepared to do that, and he's now relieving a little bit in the minor leagues, so I think he might be out of the plans altogether, which is really saying something. And furthermore, it's kind of just their scouting and development overall. I mean, we've been very complimentary of how they've been able to produce superstar pitchers like Corbin Burns and Brandon Woodruff, and they have. The pitching has been very good. But I don't think there's anybody else coming up in the pipeline. Like, they've got guys further down, but they didn't put themselves in position to survive a lot of injuries this season. And so it's kind of coming to roost, I feel like. You've got to rely on a guy like Jason Alexander, who I imagine if they had their druthers that they would only be using him in relief duty or mop-up duty or something like that. I don't know why they don't try anything else, to be honest, but that just seems to be where they're at. They don't feel like there is another option. Am I missing something? Like, does it make you think there should be some other option that they can turn to for starting innings?
It's hard to watch some of the Alexander starts, the last few, and wonder if, you know, Ethan Small couldn't give you 4 innings, 2 runs, but I'm not sure he could, and I don't think they think he could either. And there's certainly the blow-up potential now. I mean, you could point to Alexander's start, his second-to-last start against the Reds, where there was some serious blow-up there. But I think Ethan Small was probably anticipated as the guy that could fill in this role, and he has not developed as expected. And I'm not really sure exactly where he fits in the future plans. I mean, he's going to get surpassed by, if not hasn't already been surpassed by, Robert Gasser as, you know, the next guy to fill into the rotation coming up from the minor leagues. So I think Josh Lindblom, that's clearly not a avenue they want to go down. He's been pitching well in Nashville, and they just don't seem to really care at all. You wonder, like, could they go to more bullpen games? That's tough to do with a bunch of games. I mean, it worked really well, kind of with how the schedule played out, and they might have to, I think they'll have to go to one or something like that this upcoming week, or call someone up or whatnot, just without the off day. But it's I don't want to say so much it's a issue organizationally with, like, pitcher development, because they've, you know, having a year where you thought you had Ethan Small and he would be able to come up and, you know, at least help out a little bit, and he didn't. Like, it's not like having 1 year without a guy that can come up and, you know, really pitch well as a rookie at the big league level down in a playoff race. Like, that's kind of rare for that to happen. The Brewers have had it happen like last 4 or 5 years. So taking a year off from that is not like a huge organizational deal, I don't believe. I do wonder if they probably wish they had addressed starting pitching depth a little bit more, whether that's adding some more minor league free agents, Wade Miley types, you know, thinking back to like him in 2018, or maybe, you know, throwing a 1 year deal at a veteran, like a Brett Anderson type, and seeing what they can do. So it's, but at the end of the day, it's just tough because you have three injuries to starting pitchers in September. And it all kind of piled up at once. And that's just really unlucky and kind of fluky, it feels like. And that's the biggest thing to blame here. And it's really tough to plan for that.
Yeah, I mean, you got to be completely fair. I mean, no one thought that they lacked for pitching depth, starting pitching depth. That was the thing everyone was excited about with this team, is that they had six bona fide excellent starters, if Ashby panned out, and a couple other guys underneath, you know, just subterranean that might work out, Ethan Small among them. And they just kind of had a worst case scenario almost. I mean, it helped that Brandon Woodruff and Corbin Burns are both healthy for the home stretch, and Brandon Woodruff is pitching as well as he has all year. They're in very good shape when one of those two guys starts. I just don't know if they're in really, they're not in good shape when anybody else does. If it's I'm blown away that they managed to play as well as they did in that bullpen game in St. Louis when Jordan Montgomery was the opposing starter, and the Brewers just quite simply got the job done. That's one of those reverse locks. You look at the starting pitching and you think, well, it's definitely going to go one way, and it of course goes dramatically the other way. I think starting pitching overall, or even just pitching overall, I think that snuck up on us a little bit. Like that's the weakness of this team. And I don't, the offense has had its moments too. I don't know if you should say weakness is too strong, because the Brewers do still have two excellent starting pitchers who are capable of winning every time they go out. But the pitching hasn't held up what I think, certainly what the Brewers hoped it would be. And I tell you what, I was looking at the splits. I was actually kind of surprised that the pitching has improved a little bit by some metrics in the second half, and the offense hasn't improved as much as I thought by some metrics in the second half. But it sure anecdotally feels to me like the pitching has been kind of the suspect issue. Maybe not altogether, but it has been not nearly what they wanted it or needed it to be a team that can compete for a playoff spot.
Yeah, well, to kind of get at the splits thing, I feel like that's Brandon Woodruff is back in the second half and dealing, so that probably lifts the pitching as a whole. But outside of him, I think you're probably spot on with that. And I also think it's spot on to say, like, relative to expectations, the pitching has been the disappointing unit. It's not that necessarily they're like, the offense is probably what, like 12th, I think around there in the league in WRC plus and in that area for runs per game. I think pitching is like, came into Sunday 14th or 15th in MLB in ERA minus, which is just ERA adjusted for ballpark and then like weighted against the league. So a pretty good measure of that. And it probably went down. They probably dipped with our ERA going up on Sunday's loss. So league average pitching staff is, I think it was second half of league average pitching staff, is just simply like, you can't have that when you were banking on getting to 90 plus wins on the back of your pitching staff. And that's with Burns pitching pretty well still, not quite Cy Young level, but still really well, top five or, you know, top six or seven starting pitcher in the league. And then Brandon Woodruff in the second half has looked like a top three pitcher in the league, kind of hitting his ceiling. So it's been a confluence of unfortunate things. Adrian Hauser has not pitched particularly well this year. And then these injuries have really killed them too. I mean, they've gotten very little from Freddy Peralta, you know, all things considered. He's pitched well, but in terms of innings, I think they're in a totally different spot if he's making 27, 28, 29 starts like they planned on.
Let's go to the offense. One guy I wanted to ask about, we've talked about sort of individual guys. We talked about Rowdy last week with Todd and Andrew McCutchen, I think the week before that, just sort of what the long-term prognosis is. Luis Urias is really interesting to me. He's taken a step back after a pretty good year last year, after a year where I don't think you could really argue he was their best offensive player, because Willy Adames did have such a good year, but he was not bad, or close to that. And, you know, third base, I don't think defensively is ideal necessarily. He's made some plays. He had a tough play on Sunday that ultimately cost them pretty big, but I mean, it was a well struck ball. So I don't know if you see like just a ton of mistakes over there, but you definitely see some and more than maybe you'd want to see. And offensively, it's been just such a slog. But the thing is, there are no third basemen on the free agent market that this team is just going to go out and sign. There aren't many. Quite honestly, they need to go back in time and offer more for Nolan Arenado than the Cardinals did. And that would greatly, greatly solve the headaches that they're facing. Beyond that, I don't know how they improve at that position. I think Luis Urias has to be very strongly in the mix for this going forward. And I do think that's a problem. That's a spot where they could definitely stand to upgrade. What do you see in your crystal ball going forward for Luis Urias?
Well, I thought you were going to go a different direction with the question. So I'm going to answer the question you didn't ask. I thought you were going to ask, and I was prepping to answer in my mind, is that I don't know if you noticed, but David Stearns likes to make trades and things that you don't expect are coming. So I would not be shocked to see them address third base via trade this offseason. And now that I've said that they're going to, maybe I might address it via trade in the offseason, means they won't. So they're going to do what you don't expect. And then when you expect they're going to do something you don't expect, they definitely don't do that thing. So anyway, Luis Urias is, I think, the best case is he's a second baseman. He's, I think this year he's even, you know, probably almost a two-win player, which is sort of what the entire offense is. It's like an assembly line of 1.5 to 2 WAR players. And I guess that's good enough to create like a decent-ish offense. And the Brewers are above league average, fine enough with an offense like that. I just think they wanted more out of him offensively. Third base, like you said, he's passable there. And I think he could probably, you know, like we've seen this year, you can get by with giving him a bunch of starts there. But he's much better defensively at second base, less prone to making. I mean, it just seems like it makes significantly less mistakes there. And then the bat, I think, would play up a little more at second base as well. So I wouldn't be shocked, honestly, if they bring Jace Peterson back. It would not be a terrible idea. Versatile, Council loves him, gives you a good at bat, has kind of, you know, blossomed, you know, to a degree at this point of his career, after sort of being an afterthought coming into his time with Milwaukee. So it's a spot they have to address. There's a couple of those, but the season's not over yet, so we probably don't need to dig all the way to all the spots that they could address.
I mean, and Colton Wong's an interesting one because I would assume they part ways with him with the end of his contract, but...
Yeah, I think so.
I think so, too, but he's been hitting really well in the second half. I mean, defensively is the issue, though. We've seen it, and again this week, it's just been a really poor year for him defensively by his standards, and I think kind of by any standards of what you want from a second baseman. It stands to make sense that Luis Urias would be the guy to slide over there and bringing in a third baseman, but, you know, easier said than done. Kurt, you went to St. Louis for this 2-game stretch, and there was a, if you're a Cardinals fan, a really fun moment where Yadier Molina and Adam Wainwright had their, presumably, I think they're, it's not going to be their last start at home, never mind, but the record setting, the most starts for a pitcher-catcher combination in Major League Baseball history. It sounds like it was really electric there, and you would it's understandable. Those guys are obviously huge fan favorites. Albert Pujols is having a renaissance. It is a fun year to be a Cardinals fan. They're going to win the NL Central. They're way out in front. It's been above expectations for them. Of course, people are going to be excited in St. Louis. St. Louis also historically has had a ton of fan support. They routinely are among the top few markets in the country at supporting their baseball team. But like, that's a level of fun that the Brewers have not been able to achieve this year. And we've talked about that on a number of occasions. The attendance story we wrote about, that was just sort of one of the issues, that this team just hasn't captured the imagination of this fan base, either because the success hasn't been there or other things just haven't been there. The personalities or the marketing, I don't even know what we point to, because it's a little hard to quantify and really hard to pinpoint. But the Cardinals have it. And maybe it's just because they're St. Louis and they're one of the storied five franchises in Major League Baseball, and they're just always going to have it. But it sure would be nice to capture what they have. It sure would be nice to know what the Brewers are missing as their fan experience goes, as their team goes, that the Cardinals just seem to capture year after year after year. Maybe finally when these dudes retire, when Molina and Pujols and Adam Wainwright, if you just want to go to, now's a good time, in my opinion. maybe that's the key. But Kurt, it sure seems like a just broad difference, really, in environments at this point.
Well, one big difference, JR, is that the Brewers don't have Albert Pujols chasing 700 homers. Yeah, coming back to the team, and I feel like if Ryan Braun came back and was, you know, posting a 900 OPS, people would be enjoying that. And maybe they should bring him back. You know, Albert Pujols can still hit lefties at his old age. Ryan Braun can probably still hit them. Just going to toss it out there. But no, there was a thought that crossed my mind. I think Molina came up. This is his last at bat of that last game. He just came up to the plate and Pujols had just doubled in a run. And I thought to myself, these fans are having a ton of fun. Like, this just seems like a really fun year to be a Cardinals fan. And we'll see how it plays out. But it's impossible for 29 other franchises to replicate what's going on with Wainwright, Molina, and Pujols. I think that does drive a lot of it. But I mean, the big driver is the fact that they're just like good. They're really good. And Pujols and Wainwright are huge reasons for that this year. They're both playing really well. That's got to be really fun for the fans. But it's just tough to replicate. But it was funny though. I did make a comment. I was like, Paul Goldschmidt's going to finish sixth. He's going to win MVP voting this year. And he's like the sixth most popular player in this stadium to the home fans. And one of those guys is wearing a Brewers uniform right now in Colton Wong. That's crazy. So it's very strange. Very, very strange.
Yeah, that's just a different place right now. And the Brewers, if they get into the playoffs, if they find a way in, they're almost certainly going to be the number three seed in the wild card, third wild card. And they are going to go to St. Louis to face the Cardinals in the playoffs. So buckle up for that one if the Brewers are lucky enough and fortunate enough to get that far. Okay, let's go into some of the granular details from the week. It is three up, three down. Kurt, do you want to get us started or do you want me to go?
I will get us started. Why not? I'm going to go with Wednesday night's game. You briefly mentioned it. The Brewers had, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I think it was 10 hits and 4 walks, maybe 9 hits and 4 walks. Either way, they left 12 men on base, went 0-9 with runners in scoring position. Lost that game 4-1. Kind of a frustrating loss considering they had traffic all night. Here's the thing about that game is that is a successful small ball game. They just didn't get the big hit. And that embodies the entire problem with small ball, right? Is like getting 14 guys on against in a start by Adam Wainwright is a really good offensive night. But it's all banking on getting a big homer, and it's no longer small ball at that point, or, you know, somehow stringing together 5 singles instead of 2 or 3. And that's really, really difficult to do in today's game. So a good example of why small ball is really, really difficult to win with consistently, I should say.
What a microcosm of this season, because not that there have been many games like that for the Brewers, but you know, they have a lot of guys who can single. You know, they've got singles across the diamond, not just metaphorical ones, like guys who are good. They're not great, but they're good. But they don't have that hammer, you know, like Christian Yelich is probably supposed to be that guy, or maybe Keston Hira was supposed to evolve into that guy, but they don't have that superstar who's just always in the spot, the Goldschmidt or the Arenado, or I don't know, pick a poison. They don't have that guy, so they can't come up with the big hit. And that's not like how these games have gone. They haven't played a lot of games like that. That game was frustrating, but also pretty solid for the offense. Like they got all over Jordan Montgomery, a guy who had baffled them previously this season. So that was kind of a success. They just needed somebody to hit a, you know, 3-run homer, and that would be that. All right, my first 3-up, 3-down is a guy who has been hitting 3-run homers, and that's Willy Adames. He hit one on Friday to tie Robin Yount's record. This is something the Brewers themselves have been highlighting as much as they possibly can. Tie Robin Yount's record for home runs in a season, and then on Saturday, number 30, he breaks it. Robin Yount, of course, the superstar shortstop who spent his entire year in Milwaukee. I'll ask you, is this a thing, Kurt? That, I mean, Robin Yount's a big name, so that's why, and shortstop is not a high power position, so that's why. But I feel like this got played up an awful lot. Like, yeah, 31 homers is great for a shortstop. That's outstanding stuff. But also, I don't know, like it felt like a little bit of an arbitrary record. Am I off there?
I'm going to answer your question by asking you a question. What is that, Socrates, Plato? One of those dudes answered questions by asking questions, as will I. JR, did you know that X Golf opened up this weekend?
The Brewers want you to know that X Golf is open. And I've said this to many people, like the X Golf phenomenon that the Brewers are very excited about. It is unfortunate for the Brewers. It's at the wrong time of the year where the team is struggling and people are very snarky and very snippy and very stressed about the Milwaukee Brewers. There was nothing else going into that space. They should absolutely put X-Golf up there. That is a great idea. It's a novel idea. It's just people didn't want to hear about it anymore. They wanted to hear, like, how are the Brewers going to, like, get into the playoffs, man? They were supposed to win the Central. So, yes, that became a thing. That did not answer my question about Willy Adames, of course.
You can't read my answer there. I will say about Willie is very almost quiet, like very quietly. He's having a really, really good all around season. I mean, he's like their best offensive player by WAR by nearly double what their number two player is. So possible extension there might be a good idea. Question mark. Like, is that the guy to extend out of Burns, Woody, Adames when you factor in all the nuances around it?
I like that. That's a little saucy. Certainly his numbers are not appealing to the eye in every category. So I think people may miss how valuable he is offensively, although he certainly comes up big in big spots. So I don't think that's lost on people, but I'm counting that as your number two, if that's all right with you. The possibility, should they extend Willy Adames?
Sure. We can count that as my number two. Yeah. I mean, defensively he's been really good this year too. So that's, you know, the most, I'd say probably the most critical defensive position on the field, besides catcher. And he's turned into a very good defensive shortstop. And, like, you know, offensively he's having a pretty good year. Not amazing. And he's still producing at like a five WAR clip. So take that.
That's solid. All right, for me, it's Garrett Mitchell. We've talked about him a few times, but the guy, speaking of a guy whose numbers aren't great, but who just seems to come up in big spots, Garrett Mitchell, man. He hits the walk-off single on Friday. I had convinced myself that the Brewers were not going to score. They had a golden opportunity in the bottom of the ninth against Clay Holmes. And with the bases loaded, I think I don't actually remember who struck out. I think it was Jace Peterson who struck out in front of him. And I was convinced that there's no way Garrett Mitchell would come up with the hit. But the man just loves major spots. And he singled up the middle, his first walk-off hit, of course, and sent the Brewers to a really thrilling victory, battling back from five runs down. They're down 5-0 in the second, their biggest comeback of the year, to win a game. And then Garrett Mitchell scoring from first base on a double in Saturday's game was a really electrifying moment. And I think I put this out on Twitter. There aren't a lot of options adding from within to have given the Brewers what they needed, that spark that they needed really toward the late part of August, early part of September. I think Garrett Mitchell's done as well as he possibly can. You know, he's not an all-star. He maybe will be someday. But I think you and I were, as we were talking about this, kind of surprised it was him and not Sal Frelick. Sal Frelick is the guy who, and continues to mash at AAA. He was kind of the guy who looks like a true, you know, elite player coming up at some point in the near future. They went with Garrett Mitchell, a guy who can play center field. He made that diving catch last week. And he's just exciting. He seems really enthusiastic. He's really good at playing to the fans. And heck, if they need that spark, that's about as good as they could get. So this kid's been he's been something for the Milwaukee Brewers.
Yeah, he's been overmatched, I would say, a lot of the time. But it seems like when he's not overmatched, it's like in the best possible moments for him to not be overmatched. And speaking of overmatched, Major League Pitching, I don't know if you know this, but most of the year they've been overmatched by Aaron Judge. He's good. He hits the ball very far and very hard, and hit homers 58 and 59 and nearly got 60 on Sunday after the Brewers did not a great job against him the first 2 days. I mean, his numbers, you know, probably, I don't even know if I would say they did a good job against him, but they kept the ball in the ballpark. So I guess they did a fine job of not allowing him to go deep the first 2 days. And then he hits two taters on Sunday, nearly gets a third to get to 60. It was just fun to watch Aaron Judge come to Milwaukee and hit. I can't think of the last time since Bonds has there been a guy who's been having a season like that. You know, when he comes to Milwaukee and it's like, stop everything and watch at bats. I don't know.
Yeah, this was he barreled everything. Even when it was just a single, I mean, even when he made outs, he barreled everything. It was Bonds' level of like, just walk him and be done with it. Leading off the game, just walk him. You know, there's a better chance you're not going to score a run than, I mean, he's just really special right now. And that was exciting. I still think the Brewers are going to be the spot. Albert Pujols needs two more for 700. You know, they'll be coming into town in the not too distant future. That might be an interesting ticket to have. Maybe he's going to hit 700 while at American Family Field. So yeah, almost some history. We after he didn't homer in the first two games, I thought, well, he's not going to hit 60, and then hit the two on Sunday with more at-bats to come, and like, maybe I was wrong about that. He may very well get 60 in this game. One last thought that I have for 3-up-3-down. The bullpen has taken some hits, too, in terms of injuries as well. Trevor Gott probably will be back soon, maybe this next week. They could certainly use him back in the fold. That would help things out quite a bit. Matt Bush was injured and left Tuesday's game. That was that bullpen game. He left, couldn't even get out of the first. Further making that win more improbable than it already was. And I think they were optimistic that he'd be back this weekend. He didn't pitch. I'm not sure he would have been ready to do so. So, you know, you hope he's back for the Mets series because they just need all hands on deck. Like they really, given the starting situation, given that they might just have to straight up go to bullpen games here at some point again down the stretch, they need everybody. And so it would be nice for them to just finally get some health on the pitching front with Ashby back. He's going to be pitching out of the bullpen. You could see a scenario where Peralta pitches out of the bullpen once he's healthy, if he gets healthy and comes back. So there are reinforcements on the way. They got to get here soon because the Brewers are running out of time. One last thought too. Jackson Chourio up to double A. Huntsville. Oh my gosh. I dated myself.
Oh my goodness.
Wow. That's a long time ago now, friends. But Biloxi, he's got a couple hits. It's going to be a slow start for him. He only gets 1 week of minor league baseball there at double A, but he had a double. Not so bad. Nice opportunity for him to get a start, get his feet wet at double A, still at age 18. I mean, starting to wonder, like, is he going to be up at some point in 2023? Like, you can't rule it out at this point. It's unlikely still, but I don't know, man. They're pushing
it's him. It's gonna be tough. I don't think he starts at double A with I mean, I didn't watch it, but the numbers looked like it was not. I mean, he was a bit overmatched. I mean, he's 18, so I think we'll see him in Wisconsin probably to start next year, and then it'd be really tough to get up to the big like if Sal Frelick didn't get up to the big leagues this year after starting in high A with the year he's having, it's gonna be hard for 19-year-old Jackson Chourio to do it. But I've been wrong before. I don't know if you know that.
That's a really good comparison with Frelick. You're right about that. I do think he starts next year double A. I don't think Ooh. He gets to the big leagues in 2023. I don't. But a lot of it's going to depend on spring training, what they see out of him in spring training and off-season stuff, and see where he's at. And maybe 19-year-old Jackson Chourio is back in Biloxi, not Huntsville. Neighboring state. All right, let's go back in time a little bit. Look back in the not too distant past. In this case, it's Remember When.
Red hot memories, high school days.
So Clay Holmes gave up the game Friday. I mean, it didn't give it all up, but he took the loss Friday night as the Brewers rallied back for that win, that Garrett Mitchell single that we were talking about, which made me think, Kurt, of a game that we have talked about before. It's kind of an all-time favorite. Not that far back, though. 2018, Clay Holmes is on the mound for one of the most improbable wins I think I've ever watched. And I'll let you chime in with your thoughts here, but I'll real quickly run it down. If people have forgotten this game, again, 2018 is a year that they tie the Cubs and win in game 163 to win the NL Central. So every win is crucial. This is a 2018 game that went to the 15th inning at American Family Field, what was then Miller Park. And it was early hours in the morning. It was ridiculous, and it was against the Pittsburgh Pirates. The Pirates had scored a couple runs off Jordan Lyles, who was the last man left in the bullpen. They took a 6-4 lead into the bottom of the 16th, and Clay Holmes came in to close it down. He got Christian Yelich, this is MVP Christian Yelich, to ground out to open the inning. He then walks Jesus Aguilar, who moves to second on a wild pitch. He then walks Hernan Perez, which, I don't know if people are aware of this, that's extremely hard to do. It's very rare that Hernan Perez draws a walk, but that's what happened. He then strikes out Ryan Braun, the other behemoth on that team. He got Yelich and Braun out, the first two outs. And up comes Jordan Lyles. He comes up because there are no pitchers left. It has to be Jordan Lyles to take this at bat. And he does. And he draws a walk. He draws a walk against Clay Holmes to extend the inning. The bases are now loaded. And Eric Kratz, much beloved backup catcher, comes up. And Eric Kratz, you know, like I said, a beloved player, but like not a guy you necessarily expect to come through with the big hit. He did anyway. Single to center that drives in the two runs to tie the score. And with the Brewers seriously having to contemplate letting a starting pitcher work that night's game, and that could have thrown off the rotation. I think it would have been Yoli Chacin to pitch that the 16th or the 17th or whatever came next. I mean, that could have been pretty problematic for them. It comes to a point where Orlando Arcia has to get the hit. with two outs and still a couple guys on, and he does. He singles to right field. Jordan Lyles comes around to score the game-winning run, an epic 7-6 victory that the Brewers, again, they had to have. It was a wild night. It was an exhausting night, but certainly when Clay Holmes came in and gave up the win, I had to the flashback there to 2018. What do you remember about that night?
I remember I was covering high school football that night. I mean, Friday nights are late nights for covering high school football with all that has to be done. And I was done in plenty of time, to watch without working. I think like the final three innings of that game. And it was a long game. So, a late night for me, but it was a very memorable game. That and the 2019 game in Washington, where the Brewers hit what, three homers off Brad Hand, and then Hader blew it, but somehow ended up being more impressive for working his way out of the ninth inning to keep the game tied. And then
it was bases loaded, nobody out after he had given up the lead, and their best and three hitters were up.
Yep, and the next innings were pretty crazy too, if I remember as well. So those two games are kind of the two wacky ones that I remember most as those the wildest games from sort of this Craig Council era.
Yeah, that was crazy stuff. All right, let's close it down. It is, in fact, your take of the week. It's Kurt Blanche. Bring it, Kurt.
Ryan Braun sends it to left center and deep. Get up! Get out of here! Gone for Ryan Braun! He just hit a walk-off home!
All right, so on my drive down to St. Louis this week, I rented a car. It's cheaper for the company and better for me to not drive my car down and just rent one instead of, you know, doing the mileage. So, yeah, I was also not a huge fan of putting, what's that, like 600 miles on my car. It's not exactly new. So I'm all for it. And it's a smooth ride. And, you know, this one, it came with Sirius XM radio. So had that bumping and blasting on the way down and on the way back for most of the trip, and a great station that really takes me back to nostalgic days is the 2000s station. JR, I know you're a 90s guy, but I'm a 2000s guy. Although actually, to be honest, my sweet spot's like late 2000s, early 2010s. So there wasn't really a singular station for that sweet spot. But anyway, a song came on that station, and it got me thinking, this is the grooviest Brewers walk-up song of all time. There's been some really good ones, some really catchy ones, but the one that stands out most to me is Mike Moustakas's walk-up song in the 2018 playoffs, which is Blow Your Mind by Gwen Stefani and Eve. It's just it starts off with some really groovy riffs. The lyrics are catchy. And it kind of takes you back to the Moose coming up in some big spots, like game one of the 2018 NLDS and coming through. And also just, I feel like great walk-up songs of yesteryears. Also just a fun conversation topic. So I was scrolling through my head for some of the other ones as well. And I think the close second for me in this category is Logan Schaefer going with Return of the Mac.
Return of the Mac belongs in every arena, and for the most part is in every arena across America, Kurt.
Yeah, and I only heard it like a couple times, one or two times this year at Brewers games, as opposed to when Logan Schaefer, who I thought was going to be the real deal, by the way, was on the team. You'd hear it 3 to 4 times a night.
That's true. I think Frank Catalanato's Your Love always comes to mind when I try to think of walk-up songs. That's not a song I particularly like, but I just remember you heard it, and I every time I hear it, I think of Frank Catalanato. That's kind of a random one. I don't know if I have a true favorite. Let Me Blow Your Mind is not my jam. I'm not a huge fan. I enjoy that like Zach Greinke would warm up to My Kind of Party, a little country action from Jason Aldean. But I don't know. I don't know if there's one that's a favorite. I'm not a big hip hop guy. I'm more of a like 90s rock guy, and ain't nobody into 90s rock anymore. So, I don't think any current Major League Baseball players are going to be, floating that stuff. Not since Chris Capuano would warm up to Shinedown, which is not even like great rock, but it was that's more my oeuvre. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't remember them from year to year. I have to say, I apologize, Kurt.
It's okay. The good ones are the ones that stand out, and that's why Mike Moustakas stands out to me still.
Shout out to Mike Moustakas. Still with the Reds. Hasn't gone well for him. He's been dinged up a little bit, but
He's getting paid.
He is getting paid. The Brewers may see him when they go to Cincinnati for four games, their final home games of the season. That is coming up this week. So the Brewers need to make hay. They need to win those games. They need to win three or four. I mean, everything has to kind of fall right here going forward. We know this. The Brewers know this. And we will see where we land. Kurt, I'm going to send you off. Thanks for joining me, man.
All righty. Talk to you later.
All right. Now my interview with Kyle Loebner. Again, he's been around Brewers baseball a lot over the last couple decades. I'm sure you've run into his stuff, whether at the Shepherd Express or somewhere else. But he sees a lot of Timber Rattlers games. He's the official scorer for a lot of Timber Rattlers games. So talk to him about these rule changes that are coming to Major League Baseball and as they have been implemented in the Midwest League, what maybe we can expect when we see them next year at the Major League level. And also wanted to chat a little bit about some of the guys he's seen, including the aforementioned Jackson Churio. So here's my interview with Kyle, thanks for tuning in this week, guys. We will catch you again next week. Bye-bye. My guest is Kyle Loebner. If you have followed the Milwaukee Brewers for the past 20 years, I guarantee you, you've seen his name, you've seen his work. He's written for the Shepherd Express. He's written a lot for what used to be BrewerFan.net, now Brewer Fanatic. He's, man, all over the place. Kyle, maybe I should just have you give your resume a little bit. I know now why you're here is because of your work with the Timber Rattlers, but where else? Well, I'm selling you short, Kyle.
No, all over the place is a pretty good description, actually. You can find me at Shepherd Express every Monday producing the On Deck Circle. I produce feature content for the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers, including the T-Rat Talk features that run at the Monday of every homestand through the year. I produce occasional Brewer content for Milwaukee Record. I should have a piece coming up there pretty quick about the historic moments from the 2022 Brewers season. And you can find me on Twitter at @ByKyleLoebner for links to any of the stuff I may have forgotten.
I love the Milwaukee Record. Can I just say that? I don't know what kind of following they have, but I love that website. It has a lot of great stuff. Again, why I want you here today is because you are sort of the Appleton expert, the Appleton Bureau of the Milwaukee Brewers coverage team, I guess. You've done a lot of official scoring with the Timber Rattlers this, I want to say past, what is it, 3 years at this point? How long have you been there?
This was my first as the official scorer, but I've been there doing game day and other things in the press box for 7 years now. I've been in the press box with the Timber Rattlers doing media relations work and post-game podcasting and a variety of other things in addition to game day stringing and official scoring now for quite some time.
Very good. So we'll talk to you about Jackson Churio and a couple of the other players, but primarily I wanted to talk to you about the rule changes that we know now are coming to Major League Baseball next year. A lot of them have been previously rolled out in minor league baseball. The pitch clock is the big one, but there's bigger bases coming to Major League Baseball, and there's also a shift restriction, albeit maybe not as dramatic as people think, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But the big one is the pitch clock. Now, as pitchers are going to be expected to deliver a little more quickly, there are going to be some pitchers more affected than others. If you're a Milwaukee Brewers fan, that's a pretty easy thing to point out. You know that Brent Suter will not be bothered one bit, and Devin Williams is going to have to speed things up. And if you don't throw the pitch within an allotted amount of time, it's quite simply, it's a ball. It can also, if the batter is the one who's delaying things, it can be a strike. It can end an inning. The pitch clock can. So just off the top, just tell me what your overall feeling is about the pitch clock. And, you know, we can get into some of the granular stuff too, but just in general, how do you think it impacts the game? If at all, which I think it probably does based on what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I came into the year as a pretty strong detractor of the pitch clock. I didn't like it in concept. I had a lot of concerns about how the change in tempo was going to affect guys' health, how it was going to affect the flow of the game, and just generally how it was going to work. And I will say I'm still not 100% sold on it, but the vast majority of the things that I was concerned about coming into the season, we didn't see often, or at least we didn't see as often as I expected to. And so all told, it definitely changes the pace of the game. It eliminates a fair amount of dead time. I think it maybe came out a little heavier handed than it needed to be in doing so. But I think there certainly would be protests from an awful lot of folks if the high level tried to go back at this point.
Okay, so I want to start with the things that you don't like about it, or things that concerns that maybe were played out a little bit. What exactly are the things that you think still, I guess, need work? I mean, we're going to see it. It's a pretty rapid implementation as Major League Baseball goes. What do you think still needs work as we head toward the 2023 season?
The biggest challenge we had, I think, at the high A level and really across the minors, with the exception of AAA, is that the pitch clock was 14 seconds with bases empty, 18 seconds with bases occupied, which is just really fast. And so it became a real challenge very quickly to try to make sure that everything was in order as quickly as it needed to be. And then the other challenge that I think is going to come with it, that's going to carry over to the big league level, is just implementation in terms of the operator themselves. Like, every umpiring crew has a little different way they'd like it managed. When does the clock start? When do you turn the clock off? It's a lot like the play clock in the NFL, where depending on the officiating crew, some officiating crews, if it hits zero, immediately throw the flag. Some give you, you know, zero and then a beat to get the playoff. Some are a couple seconds after the zero. And when you're talking about something as quick as a 14-second pitch clock, that's a big difference. So I think trying to standardize how it's implemented could be a real challenge, especially when you're dealing with people like the Major League Baseball Umpiring Association, who kind of struggle with some of the standards they have now.
Yeah, if we think of a play clock in the NFL, I think there's enough seconds where no one's really paying attention to the moment it starts. I'm sure right. There are some instances, but when you're talking 14 seconds, people are going to want to know exactly when that thing is starting, and it's going to... It's attention will be called to it if players seem to be struggling with it. Do you get a chance to talk to players and get their feedback on how, you know, and again, I'm sure this varies from player to player and certainly pitcher to pitcher, but how have they sort of responded to it?
Yeah, we talked to a few players about it early in the year for our post-game podcast when we did interviews. We didn't talk to every player over the course of the year about it, but I think for the most part, guys were relatively positive, at least publicly. You know, and we had guys, you know, who commented, like, I can't always get to my favorite spot in my walk-up song now, you know, when I'm coming up to the plate. And I will say that the first week that we had games here in Appleton, I went to a high school game later that same week. And I watched a 16-year-old kid pimping his walk-up song till it got to his favorite part before he could get in the box. It's like, okay, I want the pitch clock here too. Because it does eliminate a lot of that from the game. And so, you know, I think for the most part, guys knew this was coming and had an opportunity to adjust to it, but it definitely changed, you know, to throw out a name, Justin Jarvis is a guy who was with the Timber Rattlers last year, who was a relatively slow worker. And I think the pitch clock really changed the tempo of his game. And maybe coincidentally, but maybe not, Justin was a lot more effective this season. And so I think some guys that are able to stay in the rhythm of it a little more might actually be helped by it. Certainly, as you mentioned with Devin Williams and probably with Corbin Burnes and Brandon Woodruff, there are some guys in the Brewers that are going to have a big adjustment to make to get under whatever the time limit is going to be at the big league level next season. But I think, like I said, most of the guys that we've talked to about it, I don't think would go back if they could.
Yeah, I think for the Brewers, just having a pitcher as important as Devin Williams makes this a little more urgent than other, you know, you don't know if it'll affect him specifically, you know, like overall, right. I think everybody's probably in favor of a faster game. But when one of your best pitchers is struggling with that, I wonder, and who knows, like you said, maybe like Justin Jarvis, it turns out to be a benefit to him or certainly not a hindrance. As far as what you were nervous about and then didn't see problems with, what were some of those things? What are examples of that?
Well, I think one of the challenges that you're going to get, especially at the developmental level, is when you get guys who are throwing 30, 35 pitches in an inning, there's a lot of pressure to get them out of there. Once you get to 30 pitches in an inning, studies show that the risk of injury goes up dramatically. And so trying to get a pitcher ready in time to get those guys out of the game is harder when they're pitching on the pitch clock and can't really slow the game down at all. And you can't give a guy time to warm up in the bullpen. We didn't see that come into play as often as I expected that it would. And we didn't see, you know, we didn't see any injuries that were directly attributed to the pitch clock. Now, I don't know how you would attribute that. But the other thing that I thought we would see more often that we didn't see at all until the last weekend of the season is a plate appearance actually decided on an automatic call. There was one the very last weekend of the season, a pitcher got down off the mound to clean his spikes and didn't call timeout, and the pitch clock ran out. And it was ball four. And I thought we would see stuff like that, you know, an automatic third strike to end an inning, or, you know, automatic balls that walk a guy more often than we did. For the most part, I think guys adjusted to it relatively quickly. Guys understood what they had to do. And for an awful lot of minor leaguers, this wasn't the first time they'd seen it. And so I think, you know, as we get towards the point where this is, happens in the big leagues, you're going to have more and more guys in the big leagues that have seen it at some point as they came up the ladder. And it's really just going to be kind of the veteran of veteran guys that haven't ever faced this before and are going to have to make an adjustment to it.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought as well. Where physically was the pitch clock? Could fans see it? Was it right on the scoreboard?
There was one in Appleton in center field, just left of the batter's eye. And then there was also one behind home plate. So every fan in the ballpark could see it from their seats. And anyone watching on MILB TV or on TV on the days the Rattlers were on could also see it behind home plate.
And did you have fans engaged with it? Like, did you ever hear, clock's up? What, you know, he's got to throw the pitch, or counting down, you know, like Giannis shooting free throws. Did you experience any of that?
Well, you know, anytime you have as many people in the ballpark and as many opportunities to drink alcohol as we have at baseball games, you're going to get some of that. It never became a big thing. I don't recall a night where I ever really directly saw the fans engage with it. If anything, early in the year, we got a lot of what's that questions.
I mean, and just as somebody who was just, I know you were working the game, but
sure.
You know, the game moves faster. Did you feel that sort of adding up as the year went on? Like, these games just aren't 3-hour events anymore. I mean, I know minor league games in general aren't going to be as long as major league games, but that there's just a crispness. It's maybe a different brand of baseball, you realize, by the end of the year.
Well, the difference was pretty striking with the Timber Rattlers, who did have some really long games last year. The Timber Rattlers did play a 9-inning game last year that went more than 4 hours. And so the difference is definitely noticeable. It creates some pros and some cons. If the game is 2 hours and 10 minutes long and fans happen to show up half an hour late because they had a hard time getting into the ballpark, or the concession lines are long and so it takes them half an hour to go get food and they miss multiple innings, I think it interacts with the fan experience in that way. And the other thing that I think is going to be a challenge for major league teams, and their goal to make concession revenue, is that when the games are short, and especially when the seventh inning comes early, the amount of time that they can sell food and alcohol is just a little bit diminished. And so I think they're going to see some changes in concession revenues, to be sure.
I had not thought of that angle of it at all. All right. Anything else that we're missing about the pitch clock that strikes you before we move to the other things?
None, except what the caveat that I probably should have led with, which is that all of my opinions about the pitch clock are exclusively my opinions and do not reflect the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers or anyone else who works there.
I should have done that. I should have pointed that out, that's the informal conversation we're having. All right. So the bases, can you sort of describe if that's a noticeable feature or if you felt that impacted the game at all?
It's a noticeable feature the first time you see it. You know, it looks like there's a large pizza box out there where there used to be a medium pizza box. And so the first time you see it, it's a noticeable difference. But in terms of impacting the game, no, I don't think it did at all. Except for, you know, it's tough to specifically identify the absence of things. There were probably a handful of occasions over the course of the year where, you know, a guy might have gotten stepped on, but he had room to slide around something or something like that. There's just a little more real estate there. But in terms of like the stated goal of increasing base stealing or anything like that, no, we didn't see it. I do think it probably makes the game a little bit safer, but I don't think it impacts gameplay at all.
Interesting. I'd be curious. I anticipate something similar at the major league level where there isn't a lot of base stealing. It's sort of been weeded out of the game for the most part with some rare exceptions. Maybe, though, you get the trickle-up effect that you're talking about with the pitch clock with this next wave of minor league players as they get used to the bigger bases. You know, maybe that's where we see the return of it, but I feel like it'd be a few years away, if at all.
Base stealing in general is just a little easier in the lower levels of the minors just because the catchers aren't universally as good. And so, you know, I don't know that it impacted the volume of bases that were stolen. I think the difference, for as much as stolen bases are often bang-bang plays and 4 inches probably does make a difference, that 4 inches just isn't big enough, I think, to be noticeable for most guys or to impact the decision to slide or not slide.
I feel like talking about the shift, it's just two apples to oranges if we're comparing major and minor league baseball. The quality of hitter, you got a lot of singles in minor league baseball anyway. I don't know if you noticed it. My interpretation of it is that it's not going to be as dramatic as people think, because most of the shifts, what we think of as shifts, are pretty close to still having two guys on each side of the field. You know, usually somebody just like 6 inches to the side of second base, or not even 6 inches, like right there at second base. But I don't know. I'm curious kind of what the players thought of that more than what you observed, and how they, if you had a chance to talk to them about it and how they felt from either side of it, offensively or defensively.
Yeah, I didn't get any player feedback about the shift. And so I'm sorry, I'm not real helpful on that. I do think that when you watch a minor league game this year as compared to a major league game, it is noticeable. And I think this is the one case where if Major League Baseball implements this rule, I think they are going to lose something. I think they're losing an element of strategy. I think they are getting a step closer to it being a paint-by-numbers game managerially. They already got one step closer by giving everybody the DH and not having to deal with double switches or any of those substitutions. And now I think they're one step closer yet by basically regulating where people can stand.
Interesting. Okay, so did you observe just a lot of pull hitters capable of getting on base a little more often because of singles, or like what would you say, was there a way to observe what you were seeing there?
Well, I think we actually were seeing a lot of shifting last year at the high A level. Teams have advanced scouting reports on guys. They understand where guys hit the ball. They're able to position for it. And they were able to develop players that could play kind of all over the infield, you know, one step closer to positionless baseball. If you have a guy who's going to be a shortstop, but he needs to know how to play way over by third base and also way over on the other side of second base sometimes. And so I think the implementation of it was interesting. And I think we're going to lose that strategy and that interest level of it. If that does come through at the big league level, that they eliminate the shift. Now you're going to see some more pull side singles for big sluggers. And, you know, you're going to see, but I don't know that particularly that's what fans were looking for. I don't know that people are going to be really excited to see that. But I think you're going to see just a couple more base runners a game, and you're going to lose an awful lot of strategy.
Were there more runs, plain and simple? Again, hard to compare because totally different team of players, totally different league of players. But did you feel like there was more offense?
I would have to look up the numbers to see specifically. I know the Timber Rattlers team ERA was down more than a run, like a run and a quarter this season. So specifically in Appleton, no, there was not more offense, but I don't know if that was quality of performance or if that was, you know, based on the rule changes.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Okay, let's get to some of these players. Word came down earlier this week, Jackson Chirillo headed to Double-A to play out the last week of the season with Biloxi, with the Double-A team. He's still just 18 years old. You got to see a lot of him this year, and he was very, very good early. I think the league got caught up to him a little bit, though. The excitement level seems to be still really sky high with this guy. And you know, people starting to dream on maybe we see him even next year or the year after that, which would be an achievement in and of itself. So give me your thoughts on Jackson Chirillo and what you saw this year from him.
Yeah, it's always interesting when we see a guy come up. And since the Rattlers became a high A team, the experience of seeing guys come up is a little different, because when we were getting guys directly from rookie ball here to Appleton, you would get guys who were hyped prospects, but, you know, they'd hit the cover off the ball in Helena and an environment at altitude and then kind of a different level of baseball. Now that they're making the jump from low A, we're getting guys who are kind of polished and ready to be immediate contributors at the high A level. I don't think the gap between levels is as big. And so I was curious to see, having seen a fair number of hyped prospects come through before, how Chirillo would compare to them. And really there's almost zero negative to say about him. He's a guy who does pretty much everything on the diamond well. He's extremely athletic. He's a really gifted hitter with good plate discipline. You know, pretty much everything he was advertised to be, he came up to Appleton and showed pretty quickly, both in terms of his contact skills and his ability to put the ball in play. But also just tremendous power for a guy who was the youngest player at his level. I said to some people early in his run in Appleton that his performance in Appleton would have been a really big deal if he was 22 or 23, like everyone else in that league. But the fact that he was doing it at 18 really puts him in unique and special territory.
What did you get a sense how the Appleton community or the greater Fox Cities community sort of rallied around that? I mean, obviously for Brewers fans, it's pretty exciting to have this kind of super prospect now in your backyard. He's so fast rising. I don't know if anybody got a chance to catch their breath to really contextualize what it's like to have somebody of his caliber in the organization before, you know, before his time with Appleton was over. Were there more fans in the stands? Was there more attention paid to his at-bats? Did you feel like that sort of energy was there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, anytime you're at minor league baseball games, you're watching kind of two different things, because a big chunk of the crowd is there just for the entertainment aspect of it and would have no idea who any of the guys were on the field. But certainly having someone like Churio there attracted a fair number of the other kind of baseball fans, the people who were actually there to see the baseball, who were there to see the prospects, and who were there to maybe get an opportunity to witness a potential future star. And so I think we've seen a fair number of pretty highly hyped prospects come through Appleton in recent years. You know, we had Antoine Kelly earlier this year, Sal Frelick, had Garrett Mitchell, number one picks come through. The level of hype that was around Churio was definitely a step or two up from that. And I don't know that there's anybody else who has come through Appleton in my time here that I think was probably as hyped before they got here as Churio was.
All right, I'm kind of interested in this catcher, and I don't know if his first name is Jefferson or Jefferson Caro. He is also very young. Also, I believe he's just 19. He might even be younger than that.
Right.
But certainly another one of the top prospects in the organization. The Brewers have had a lot of catching prospects in the organization over the past few years that I don't want to say they haven't panned out. We don't really know where Mario Feliciano is going to end up, but you know, Peyton Henry got traded. They had a couple other guys that never really, you know, sort of panned out. So I guess I'm a little more cautious with Caro, but you saw a lot of him this year. So how does he compare to what you'd expect for someone at that level?
I think you can make a reasonable argument that if all of these guys, the new guys who came to the Rattlers this season, had come in with no hype and we had just gotten to know them based on what they do in Appleton, that Caro would be the one we talk about most often. Because he was able to stay on the field a little more than Churio was. Churio had some injury issues, and so just his body of work was a little smaller. But Caro, especially the last 2 weeks of the season, just really turned it on offensively. Had like a 10-game hitting streak where he was batting .500. Like it seemed like he was always on base. He was hitting for power. He is very good behind the plate. He's a pretty good guy at limiting the run game. And so I think, you know, he is probably as close to anybody we have seen to being a real deal future catching prospect. And that says a lot, because the Timber Rattlers have had all the guys that you mentioned before, all the catching prospects that you said, that the guys we've been hearing about for years. And so I'm really curious to see what the Brewers will do with Caro this winter and what the assignment will look like for him next spring. But yeah, I think in a vacuum, without knowing in advance who Jackson Churio was, Caro might be the guy that we spend more time talking about this season.
How about defensively? How is he behind the plate?
I think he looks pretty good back there. And it's tough, because I think a big part of developing a big league catcher is just getting him a ton of reps. And so you've got a guy who's 19. He's not going to have had all the experience back there that others have had. But he caught a lot down the stretch. He was able to work with, you know, both Latino pitchers and English speakers back there. And I think he was able to call a better game than maybe you would expect from someone of his experience level. Certainly Timber Rattlers pitchers didn't suffer at all with him back there. And so I think it's always going to be a challenge to try to get a guy who is advanced at a young age, enough reps to learn as a catcher, because I'm not sure there's any replacement for just the lots of practice. But I think right now he looks, you know, every bit as good as you could expect him to be as a 19-year-old behind the plate.
All right. I'm curious who else we should know about. Now, we've talked briefly on this podcast about Carlos Rodriguez, the pitcher, who came a little later in the season and has really performed well. Tyler Black is a guy that is pretty highly regarded in this organization, but had a pretty truncated season with injury. So I don't know how big of a scouting report you have on those guys, but if not them, who else jumps to mind?
Well, down the stretch, there were three pitchers that joined the Rattlers that all were exceptionally good. In Rodriguez and Steven Cruz and a third whose name I am not going to be able to recall off the top of my head. But you know, there were several guys that joined the Rattlers down the stretch that I think really changed their career trajectory, just kind of with their performance. You know, in the season's final weeks, and just about every week you get, or just about every year you get a guy or two like that who come to Appleton, have an opportunity to be more than you know, maybe they were in Carolina, and really make a statement in those final weeks. And the Rattlers had that this year on the mound. Tyler Black, who you mentioned before, is another guy who in almost any other year would have been the prospect from the season that we talk about. A guy who is a middle infielder, but also one of the team's best and most consistent hitters, a base stealer. You know, he learned to play center field on the fly this year and was able to do that relatively well. There would have been an awful lot of years where we would talk about Tyler Black as the best player who played for the Timber Rattlers all year and still be pretty happy about it. And so the fact that he's gotten overshadowed by guys like Sal Frelick and Jackson Churio really probably shouldn't be held against him. He just happens to be coming through town at the same time as a lot of elite prospects. I think the other name to bring up, a guy who came up around the same time as Churio and Caro, is Eduardo Garcia, a shortstop who is also extremely young for his level, but makes all the plays over there and can really also carry the team with his bat. And so I don't know if there's ever been a year since I started covering baseball in Appleton, and I go back to 2012, where there's been as many guys come through this organization. It's like, oh yeah, this guy is likely a future big leaguer and maybe an impact one. I think the group of talent we saw this year stands out from any other I have seen.
Well, that's great news for Brewers fans. Let me let you go with one last question. Asking about a guy who isn't there, Tristan Peters, traded midseason in the Trevor Rosenthal acquisition. It looks like the Brewers are going to get nothing out of that. Trevor Rosenthal got hurt. It was already kind of risky. Hadn't played since 2020. It looks like that's going to be just a loss. And I mean, like I've said before on this podcast, Tristan Peters, you know, he wasn't a top 15 guy. He also wasn't, you know, he didn't need to be added to the 40 man or anything. Like, there was no deadline on him. He was still young and he was producing at a really high level. I guess I'd be curious your thoughts on what you saw from him. And I mean, the background question is, are the Brewers going to regret this one?
You know, I really love Tristan Peters. And so it was tough for me to see him go. And it was doubly tough to see him go for a guy that didn't pan out the way the Brewers had hoped. Peters was in a year with a ton of stars, and all the guys we've mentioned, Peters was probably the most consistent guy. The guy that night in, night out, you knew was going to be at the top of the lineup. He was going to get on base once or twice. He wasn't always flashy in the way that he did it. And so I think maybe you could make an argument that the top of his upside was relatively limited compared to some of the other guys in the organization. And certainly as a guy who plays the outfield, it's a tough time to make headway in the Brewers organization right now with a lot of prospects playing the outfield. But I am really excited for Tristan Peters getting an opportunity to go to an organization that wanted to acquire him and hopefully give him an opportunity to grow. I already owned a Richmond Flying Squirrels jersey before Tristan Peters went there, but if I hadn't, I might have bought one after Tristan Peters went there, because he's a guy that I really enjoyed covering this year and a guy that I really think has a bright future.
If you know Kyle Loebner, you are not surprised that he owns a Richmond Flying Squirrels jersey. Kyle, really appreciate it. Do you have anything to plug, or you just, you know, I could send people to your Twitter account, but what do you got cooking right now?
You can find me on Twitter at by Kyle Loebner. You can also find me at Shepherd Express, producing the On Deck Circle every Monday all the way through the winter. My T-Rat Talk features from this year are still up at TimberRattlers.com, including the one we did to wrap up the season with manager Joe Arolt. And again, in the weeks ahead, I'll be back at Milwaukee Record producing the year in review piece with all the moments I added to my Today in Brewer History calendar this year.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Kyle. I really appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. Have a good day. Glad to be part of your sports experience.